dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man that I have been privileged to become familiar with and very impressed by, both his intelligence as well as his long and distinguished service to our country, is a retired senior special agent of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the host of the Michael Cutler Hour on Friday evenings at Blog Talk Radio, and a very frequent contributor to the public policy debate at Front Page Magazine, and, well, here as Secure Freedom as well. His name, of course, is Michael Cutler. Welcome back, Michael. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. By the way, I wish you and all your listeners very happy holiday season, happy Hanukkah, happy Christmas, happy New Year, too, as the holidays rapidly approach.
And to you, too. Let me ask you, Michael, about something that you've written about that I think has not gotten nearly the attention it requires, and that is this recent attack by a Saudi national that killed several of our American citizens in Pensacola Naval Air Station, and what we are to make of how this came about, and more to the point, what lessons it teaches us about how we're dealing with the immigration problem writ large.
Well, it's a great question and something that I've been deeply concerned about since prior to 9/11. Look, we have a serious problem on the Mexican border that gets a lot of attention, a lot of money, a lot of headlines, but what people seem to forget is that most of the terrorists who've entered the country enter through ports of entry. The vetting process, the process by which visas are issued, really lacks integrity. And I did my very first congressional hearing back in 1997 on that issue because of the 93 attacks. The Clinton administration ignored those vulnerabilities. We had 9/11, and we still haven't learned those lessons. The alleged gunman was somebody we admitted on a visa to attend flight school at Pensacola. Now, this startles me because it's not just giving people access to military bases and access to our country, which is frightening enough when we don't do it properly. But we were putting this guy through training that would make him the equal to the best pilots in the world. You know, I testified at that hearing back in 2002 about how two dead terrorists got permission to go to a civilian flight school. That was worrying. But here we're talking about putting somebody in the seat of a supersonic fighter plane, and we still don't even know who in the world that we're training. The other Saudis have been grounded. But what's the lesson to be learned? First of all, and I know that the members of the military are now asking to be able to carry firearms on their bases, which of course makes perfect sense. These are the best trained warfighters in the world. Why can't they defend themselves? But the bigger issue is we've got to reexamine the way by which we legally admit aliens into the United States, because that process is fatally flawed.
Yeah. Michael, what you're talking about is the fact that large numbers of people are admitted here every year legally. Many of them come and overstay their visas as well as, you know, do whatever it is they're supposed to have done, presumably. That's a problem in its own right. But what you're saying is, in addition to the overstay problem, there are difficulties in terms of letting people in the first place who shouldn't be in our country. What is your recommendation with respect to how we screen to try to ensure that we're not admitting, well, in this case, Sharia supremacists who are willing to use violence against us?
Great, great question. And the problem is that the vetting system is fatally flawed. You know, how do you predict the future? It's almost like the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report. We're going to predict the future. You know, at the beginning of my career, I was an immigration inspector at Kennedy Airport. I sat in that booth. As I put it when I testified at the Arizona lawsuit against, or the DOJ lawsuit against Arizona, as an inspector, I had my eye to the peephole on America's front door. And I did that for 4 years before I became a special agent. So understand that the inspector gets about a minute to make a decision about whether or not to admit an alien, and the consular officials don't have much more time than that then how do you predict the conduct of a 21-year-old? You know, you don't just run fingerprints and magically you know what's in this guy's head. You admit somebody and then you hope that they don't do harm to us. We have almost no ICE agents to do field investigations to look for people who overstayed. Nearly as many aliens who are here illegally violated the terms of their lawful admission as ran the border. And it's not just overstaying. Many are working illegally. That creates a problem for our economy and for American workers and their wages. It also involves people committing crimes. And then you have sanctuary cities. And sanctuary cities, of course, shield people from detection who violate the immigration laws.
On the sanctuary cities bit, you've been warning for some time that this is a security problem, not just an economic one. Give us a flavor, Michael, of what we're looking at now as these cities become rife with criminality. They seem to be incapable of addressing that problem as long as they are essentially hampering law enforcement's abilities to operate there.
Well, it's not that they're incapable. They have absolutely no desire. They would rather see people die, innocent victims, than enforce immigration laws in conjunction with immigration law enforcement authorities. You know, we traditionally enforce laws as a team. As an inspector at the airport, I would stop people wanted for murder warrants and robbery warrants, even though it was a city or a state warrant. Normally, the local government assists the federal government if we're talking about tax evaders or drug dealers or kidnappers. Immigration is no different. You know, our country's borders are our first and last line of defense. And think about this. We all know about El Chapo Guzman, the most notorious drug trafficker from Mexico. Where was he placed on trial? He was placed on trial here in Brooklyn, New York, because Queens, New York became drug central. Now, when you stop and think about it, this makes no sense. Of course, we have access to airports and seaports and so forth. It's a hub. But New York has the biggest police department in the United States, maybe the world, over 38,000 police officers who are well-trained and well-equipped. Why would you set up shop in a city with that big a police department to carry out illegal activities? And El Chapo's assistant, if you will, was the chief of enforcement in the Mexican government. He was just arrested here in New York, where he's wanted for major drug trafficking. Why New York? Because New York is a sanctuary city. You're inviting people into the country knowing full well that the city of New York will stand between them and immigration law enforcement. This is an act of national suicide, but it's not just for New York, because sanctuary cities can then become a staging area for terrorists who can move into a sanctuary city, do whatever they have to do, and then go from that city to wherever they want to carry out an attack. And further complicating the issue is that New York State now issues driver's licenses to illegal aliens. You know, the weapon of choice for terrorists around the world is no longer airliners. I can't think of the last time an airplane was used in a terror attack. Motor vehicles are the weapon of choice, especially trucks. When you give somebody a driver's license, you enable them to rent motor vehicles anywhere in the United States that could then be used as part of a terrorist attack. And New York State thinks they're doing something marvelous. Ironically, it was New York that was hammered the worst on 9/11. This is delusional. It is dangerous.
And it is suicidal, as you say. Michael Cutler, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but we look forward to talking with you often in the new year and hopefully helping effect the kinds of course corrections that are so clearly needed with respect to sanctuary cities and immigration more generally. Thank you for your service to our country, my friend. Come back to us soon after, I hope, very happy holidays.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by Charles Sam Faddis, a valued colleague, a distinguished public servant who has rendered such service in a variety of capacities. He was an assistant attorney general in Washington State. He has been a clandestine operative in the Central Intelligence Agency for some 20 years, including service as the chief of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Division at the Central Intelligence Agency. He has been a tank officer in the United States Army, a judge advocate general there, and a candidate for Congress, no less. An extraordinary, distinguished, and very substantial contributor to our work here at Secure Freedom Radio. We're always delighted to have him. Welcome back, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
You've written recently a very provocative and I think quite timely piece entitled The Hidden Hand at andmagazine.com. Talk a little bit about the thesis of that piece, Sam, and how it now seems to becoming more and more obvious that that's been at work in our government in recent months and years.
Right. Well, sort of the thesis of this article is to point out that the Inspector General's report is fine, I suppose, on a macro level as far as it goes.
This is the report with respect to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act matters.
Right. IG Horowitz's report, which is focused on the FBI and sort of the FISA warrants and the process used to get these warrants. During the course of this ridiculous investigation of Trump and the Trump campaign and the Trump presidency. And it's fine, I guess, in large measure as far as it goes. I would still have some issues with it on that level. But the biggest thing that it misses, in my opinion, is that, look, you're basically looking at a stage play with a bunch of marionettes who are performing various actions, and you're reporting on those actions. And what you're not discussing at all is the fact that every single thing they do is in response to strings that are being pulled. So this idea that all we're looking at is a bunch of FBI agents who became overzealous or partisan and abused a process, it misses the central point and the much bigger issue, which is this is all a conspiracy. This was all a very deliberate effort against first candidate and then President Trump. And the real question here is, who constitutes that hidden hand? Who are the players off screen, off the set, off stage, who manipulated this and controlled it the entire time? And that's really where we need to end up in terms of investigation.
And that was not really laid out in the Horowitz report on FISA. The closest we got to it, I guess, is his statement in congressional testimony after it was released to the effect that maybe the events that he's chronicled were prompted by grievous incompetence or malign intentionality. But he doesn't get into who was the malign intentional driving force, does he?
No, he doesn't come anywhere near that. And a part of this, to be fair, is driven by what his mandate was. And so I get that. I still think that he stopped short of where he still should have gone. I'll give you just an example. There are zillions of them. The inception of the investigation, there's a report that this guy, George Papadopoulos, junior member of the campaign, has a single conversation with a gentleman who's apparently reporting to the Australian service, although the service is not named in the IG report. And Papadopoulos says what are, frankly, some very amorphous things about Russians having access to Hillary's emails and that kind of thing. And this single report then comes into the system, which, as you well know, receives tens of thousands of reports from all over the planet every day. And on any given day, that report would attract no notice. Nobody would care. Nobody would do anything. It's just another random thing some guy said to some guy on the other side of the planet. In this case, the next thing you know, you literally have the most senior levels of the FBI, including Director Comey, personally involving themselves with that single report. And according to the IG, on that basis, directing a full-fledged investigation of the Trump campaign, multiple clandestine human sources, multiple wiretaps, etc. I'll just tell you, from a lot of decades of experience in the intelligence community, no way. That would never happen. That didn't just happen. That was a pretext used by senior people to create, stand up an investigative unit with the intention of then feeding the Steele dossiers into that investigation. That's how this plot was supposed to work.
Well, so let me ask you, Sam, you mentioned one of the senior players, James Comey, who at the time was the director of the FBI. As it happens, yesterday he appeared on one of the Sunday programs, Fox News, and seemed to be, as ever, completely unmoved by this kind of evidence of his own malfeasance at best, and at worst, you know, intentional effort to subvert the election process of the United States. What did you make of his remarks and his role, as we now understand it, in this affair?
Well, his explanations are just weak and nowhere close to sufficient. And, you know, now this is sort of standard playbook by particularly individuals who aren't necessarily all that bright. It's, okay, wait a second. I've now gone from being 100% certain that the president was a Russian spy to, well, I guess that's not true. And I'll give you that some people did some things that were less than optimal. But still, basically, nothing to see here. Definitely no conspiracy. Can't we all just move on? Way too late and nowhere close to sufficient explanation.
He took obvious pleasure in seeming to assert that his mother's fears that he was going to jail were misplaced based on this IG report. Do you see, as a former assistant attorney general in Washington State, a basis for his prosecution in all of this?
Well, absolutely. I think the reality is that in terms of numbers of individuals involved in this conspiracy, fully witting of what was going on and understood not just that they didn't like Trump, but that they understood they were involved in a criminal action, I don't think you need hundreds of people to have pulled this off. On the other hand, you didn't do it with one or two people either. There does have to be a core group of conspirators. And the guy at the very top of the FBI who begins this whole thing by directing a full-fledged investigation on virtually no pretext. I mean, something that's just, I mean, if you're in the business, you know, is just makes no sense. It just defies the law of physics. That guy has to have been in on this. I mean, in my opinion, I cannot possibly see how you did this. There are also multiple points after that where there's intervention from the most senior levels of the FBI, clear and inexplicable without, in my opinion, some sort of conspiratorial mode. And so he's one of the essential guys.
So let me ask you, Sam Faddis, who else would you suggest constitute the sort of core members of this hidden hand, if you will, this conspiracy to overthrow the candidate Trump initially, and then President-elect Trump, and then ultimately President Trump?
Right. Well, I mean, in my opinion, based on what I've seen, obviously people within Hillary Clinton's campaign, starting with, and that would include the head of Fusion GPS for these purposes. I don't see how this happens without John Brennan at the top of the CIA. And frankly, knowing the CIA intimately the way I do, there has to be at least a handful of additional people within the CIA, at least a couple more. And that by that, I mean individuals who were fully witting of what they were involved in. After a certain point, you're going to get to the level where the working class guy is simply told, this is a very tightly held, compartmented operation based on information you don't need to know. Take this specific action, and you're probably going to get to the point where people thought they were doing something legitimate. But John Brennan could not do this by himself at the top. So we ought to be looking at the very senior levels of operations and probably places like London, since there's a lot of evidence of British connection to this.
Yes. And as we've talked about before, Gina Haspel, the current director of the Central Intelligence Agency, of course, was the chief of station for the Central Intelligence Agency during the relevant period in London, and would seem to me to be probably included in that mix of people who would have been knowing, witting, and ought to be investigated as such. Let me ask you, Sam Faddis, about another locus of involvement in this hidden hand business. What would you assess, again, based just on what we've seen so far, was the degree of awareness of and involvement in all of this by President Barack Obama himself?
Well, I was just having this conversation earlier today with a colleague. That's a very, very good question. Does it of necessity have to have involved the sitting president at that point? I think you can imagine that it was run without his complicity. But given what we have seen, it doesn't change the fact that there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. Because, clearly what we see now is we just saw a conspiracy and a coup attempt. And I can't think of anything more potentially fatal to the Republic. So nobody at this point, I think, gets the benefit of the doubt. Right? Nobody gets, there's no such thing as that's not possible anymore, given what we've seen. Those questions have to be answered.
They do indeed. Let us pray that John Durham is going to get to the bottom of this. It seems more likely than the United States Senate in the impeachment proceedings. But one way or the other, we do need the facts to out. Sam Faddis, thank you so much for your great work. Come back to us again in the new year.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent authorities on matters involving our national interests in and the developments that are taking place that are likely to affect us from communist China and other parts of Asia, among other places. He writes for the Daily Beast and National Interest. He's a regular at Fox News. He's the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. You can follow him at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, we spoke late last week about the then pending trade agreement, a phase one agreement with China. It is now, we're told, complete. I guess it won't be formally initialed until sometime next month, but give us your current reading, Gordon, on its contents, as best we know them, and its likely impact.
Yeah, the phase one trade deal, at least as it was announced, does not look favorable for the United States. We only have a skimpy term sheet from the U.S. trade representative, but from what we can see, I think that Beijing got the better of the U.S. President Trump had a strong hand, and I don't think he played it well. The point here is that we gave up something really important. As a matter of fact, we've already given it up. Yesterday, on Sunday, the U.S. did not impose the 15% tariffs on about $160 billion of Chinese goods, and we don't even have an agreement yet. And it won't be a signed agreement, if there is one at all, until next month. But what we gave up for the tariff concessions is essentially a Chinese vague promise to buy more U.S. agricultural products. Apparently, the agreement will not have a firm commitment on the amounts to be purchased. And the most important point is that China would have bought U.S. ag anyway, deal or no deal. So I'm not sure what we got. There's some vague promises in the term sheet, but we've seen those before. China's really, really good, Frank, at not honoring its obligations.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's really, really bad for us, I think, to the extent we depend upon them. Gordon, Larry Kudlow was on one or more of the Sunday programs over the weekend and spoke rather effusively about some enforcement mechanism that is baked into this agreement. Do you know what he's referring to, or is it evident that there is such a thing and how it would work?
Yeah, the term sheet talks about a consultation mechanism. And, you know, we can consult with the Chinese anyway. So I'm not so sure that this is an enforcement agreement. And by not going forward with the tariff increase and by rolling back some tariffs, you know, we have taken away the enforcement incentives that we had. So I don't think that there's anything there. Of course, we have not seen the final agreement. But if it's anywhere close to the term sheet, I think Kudlow is not representing the deal as it should be. So we've got to be very concerned about this.
When we spoke last week about it, Gordon, you emphasized the particular reason for concern, and that is that one more time, it seems, we've stepped into the breach to help bail out Beijing under circumstances that I think, to his credit, Donald Trump has substantially helped create, namely real economic pressure on the Chinese communists for the first time in a long time. Give us a sense of what the geostrategic implications of that step would be, if that's in fact the practical upshot of all this.
Yeah, China is heading for some very difficult times. Even without President Trump's tariffs, it had a slumping economy. And that's a number of reasons for that. Too much debt. Also, Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, believes in a state-dominated economy. So he is snuffing out the private sector, the domestic Chinese private entrepreneurs, and in addition, of course, foreign companies. But Trump's tariffs were actually, I think, aggravating the situation there. And that's a good thing for us, because if we're going to have a peaceful resolution of China's challenges to the free world, it's going to be because they fail internally. So by stepping in to create confidence for China, which is what President Trump did with this phase one trade deal, he's rescued Chinese communism. And this very well may be an historic rescue, something that we remember along with President Nixon going to Beijing in 1972, George H.W. Bush bolstering China after the Tiananmen massacre, and President Clinton's 1999 trade deal, which rescued China at a time when its economy was in trouble and it was going through other difficulties. So this could be historic. And if it were, it would be an historic mistake for the United States.
Gordon, what role do you see Wall Street playing in this decision by President Trump? Is it your assessment that he's been persuaded not only that, of course, a booming stock market is going to be good for his reelection, but that the price of getting a booming stock market over the next few months and, well, run up to the election will be keeping Wall Street happy in terms of its ability to make money propping up China as well?
I don't know what's in the president's mind, but clearly you had Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and you had the heads of Wall Street firms urging the president to go forward with some sort of deal with China. We know that they've urged the president to concede to China many times in the past, as they've done in recent weeks. So we can assume that their influence this time as well as in the past was not benign. And also, you know, this is not just Wall Street. Of course, it's the big multinationals, chambers of commerce, you name it. They all were persuading the president, urging him to go forward with the deal, which I believe was not in the best interests of the United States.
Yeah. I guess I use Wall Street as kind of a euphemism for all of the above, but particularly Wall Street seems to me to be the bad actor in all of this, insofar as it is profiting from the effective transfer of immense amounts of American wealth in the form of investments, pension funds, institutional investors, private individuals, to companies that are doing business that are, Chinese Communist Party tied companies, let's be clear. And we've talked in the past, Gordon, about the strategic error of that practice, especially insofar as it's enabling a lot of malevolent activities by China. And so I see them as kind of the principal malefactor here, though I agree with you, there are clearly others at work. To the extent that this is a factor, I would argue, add tremendously to the historic error of this approach.
Yes, well, certainly. Right now, the U.S. is at a critical moment with China because China's become increasingly bold. And one factor, Frank, that people generally have been ignoring is that on December 1st, China went forward with its multi-level protection scheme 2.0, which essentially requires foreign companies to provide data, all their data in China, to the Ministry of State Security and to other Chinese authorities, because they can no longer use encryption, which prevents their data from being seen by the Chinese government and by the Communist Party, which means that China is in all, it has the ability to take all the data, all the communications of foreign companies. And once they have the encryption keys, Frank, for the China networks, it gives China increased ability to get the information and data from these companies outside China. So essentially, it's a real possibility that China could just buy the entire Fortune 500 after it cripples them by stealing all of their information. I don't see anything in the term sheet that says that this is part of the deal, that China will not go forward with these December 1 rules. And by the way, it gets worse on the first day of next month when China's cryptology law, sometimes known as the encryption law, goes into effect. So we have China's attack on foreign companies in China, their networks, and I don't really see very much at all or anything of a response from the administration. This is another failure.
And far from actually fixing the predatory practice of stealing our intellectual property, it seems as though under these circumstances, Gordon Chang, what you're saying is that it's going to be vastly worse.
Absolutely, because China will be able, and you know, foreign companies don't have to just sort of give the data to China when it asks. China will be in a position to take the data when foreign without the consent and without the knowledge of foreign companies, because they'll have the encryption keys. So they'll be able to poke around networks at any time they want.
Yeah, this is very alarming stuff. And it's the sort of thing we've been focusing on, of course, often with your good help, Gordon Chang, at the Committee on the Present Danger of China. And I commend to our listeners, once again, the website there for more information on many of these topics, presentdangerchina.org. Gordon, we only have about 2 minutes left, but let me just ask you quickly about North Korea. Special Envoy Steve Biegun, who's been nominated to become the Deputy Secretary of State, is, I believe, on the Korean Peninsula as we're speaking, is supposedly trying to get some sort of understanding with the North Koreans. The North Koreans, meanwhile, have tested what I suspect is more intercontinental range missile relevant technology. What's your current reading on the state of play with respect to North Korea and the effort of President Trump to denuclearize it?
Well, Mr. Biegun right now, as you say, is trying to start working level talks again, and he's in South Korea. The North Koreans seem to be resisting. As you point out, twice this month, it appears that they have tested the engine for an intercontinental ballistic missile at their Sohae launch site, which they promised to dismantle. So right now, things are going to some sort of crisis point. The North Koreans have given the U.S. a year-end deadline to come to a deal. Biegun has said that's not a real deadline. But, you know, the North Koreans will do something provocative, if not this month, at least in the next couple months, as they try to enforce their deadline on the U.S.
Stay tuned, folks. We'll be watching this closely with Gordon Chang. Thank you for being our duty expert on all these matters, Gordon, as well as all of the rest of the service you're providing to our country and helping to clarify both what's going on and what the stakes are. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us next week.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by a dear friend and much admired investigative journalist, perhaps the best of her generation. Claudia Rosette is her name. She has been involved in covering some of the most important issues of our generation from vantage points like Moscow and Hong Kong and Washington, New York, and beyond. She has been reporting and editorial writing for the Wall Street Journal in the course of her distinguished career. She is a prize winner in the journalism business, as well as an extraordinary intellect and contributor to the public policy debates. Now a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. Claudia Rosette, we're delighted to have you back. Welcome. It's good to catch up with you.
Thank you, Frank. It's wonderful to be here.
So, Claudia, we talked a little bit in the previous segment with Gordon about the trade agreement that President Trump has been laboring to accomplish. We have now a phase one, it's called. How has the issue of this trade accord factored into the administration's conduct of policy towards Hong Kong? And where do things stand in that regard now, as you see it?
Yeah, Frank, the actually unsatisfactory answer I'm going to give you is that I think we don't know, okay? I think there's a surface appearance, and but I'm not sure that we have heard or seen everything that's going on. I was interested in the claim that Trump made a while back that, you know, but for him, the People's Liberation Army would have gone into Hong Kong. It's easy to dismiss that as chaff. I wouldn't do that out of hand. I think there's been a lot of pressure applied in quiet ways and a whole debate going on inside the administration with people who are saying they don't want Hong Kong to be connected in any way to negotiations on trade. I think that's unrealistic. It's the Chinese see this all as a peace. I'm sure of that. And I think the U.S. has to do the same thing. It's not something you can neatly compartmentalize. So I wish I had an omniscient answer for you. But I think the answer is it looks on the surface, I would say I'd like to see Trump speaking out more often and more clearly on why Hong Kong matters. It's a free society, that we will stand by it and care about it, and that China must not do terrible things there. But I do wonder if that message has been part of what's been brought into this whole scene more than we're actually seeing.
We will know more later, I guess, is the short answer to this question. But let's talk a bit about what's going on in Hong Kong at the moment. Claudia, you have been reporting from there off and on. We've caught up with you now back in the States. But tell us what your reading is on how the recent extraordinary votes in the local elections and the very large peaceful demonstrations that took place in the past 2 weeks have, you know, affected the current state of play with respect to the people of Hong Kong and their aspiration to enjoy freedom and autonomy from Beijing.
Well, the people there are just incredible, Frank. If I may tout an article I've just published, which gets into this in detail. I have a piece on City Journal called A Defiant Stand for Freedom that gets published last week, which gets into really a lot of detail on this. This is sort of pulling together what I've seen over the past few months, again, on City Journal. A defiant stand for freedom. That's what's going on there. And the people of Hong Kong are not backing down. They're saying they really care about this. It's very interesting. Unlike a lot of the nonsense, I've really been thinking about this. In societies where we have freedom, the great risk is that we take it too frivolously. You know, I fear often about that in America, yes. And in Hong Kong, they take it as incredibly important. And there are people there who have been saying for months, they're willing to die for freedom. I believe them because they truly are risking their lives. The problem is they're up against China, and China clearly has nothing good in mind for Hong Kong. The chief executive has just been up in Beijing to consult with Xi Jinping. We wait to hear exactly what comes out of that, but I don't anticipate that she's going to come back and say, oh, you know, democracy is fine. We promised that to you. You can have it. China basically is trying to preserve Hong Kong's banking system and the airport and other profitable utilities that are useful for Beijing, but it doesn't care anything for the promises that China made to the 7.5 million people of Hong Kong.
And Claudia, just give us a sense of how these expressions of popular sentiment, again, the local elections and the large, I think it was something like 800,000 people out of a population, yes, of 7 million or so, in the streets of Hong Kong, peacefully demonstrating their support for those protesting on behalf of liberty. How does that, you know, factor into the state of play with Carrie Lam and with Beijing and so on?
Beijing and Carrie Lam are trying to pretend it away. I mean, I was there for the march a week ago Sunday when an estimated 800,000 people walked through the streets. And that was, again, that's incredible. When you think about it, they're at risk of, they know at this point, just how brutal the police can be. And the police there have really turned brutal. They've basically just been, it's operating as a police state in that sense. And they attack not only people who are committing, on the protest side, who are committing violence or vandalizing things. Although, again, please note, they are not stealing. This isn't looting. It's a message. It continues to be a message, whatever you think of the violence. But the great majority of these protesters are peaceful, and they keep coming. They've been doing this, actually, they've been doing it for years, but this sort of movement that really came together last June in opposition to a bill that would have allowed extradition to China, and then when Carrie Lam, the chief executive, refused to completely withdraw it, they turn to the actual underlying problem, which is they have no power under the rigged system China has given them. They have no power to elect or to depose their own chief executive or the majority in their legislature, in their lawmaking body. In other words, they have a free society, but it is administered by what's effectively the apparatus at this point of a police state, of a dictatorship, of a China, an arm of China, of China's tyranny. And that's the tremendous conflict and problem that's playing out in the streets. And people in Hong Kong really understand freedom, democracy. They prize it. They value it. They want it. And they are not willing to just say that, nope, we're going to roll over and surrender. So that's what you're still seeing.
Well, and this is what we need to help, I think, encourage and enable. Let me ask you, Claudia, there is a new reference being made to a national security law that Beijing seemingly is intent on imposing on Hong Kong.
Yes.
What's going on with that, and what are the implications of it for this aspiration for freedom?
It's called Article 23 is the buzz phrase from the article in Hong Kong's mini constitution from the 97 handover. This is a provision that says that there will be laws sort of passed to safeguarding national security. In other words, laws against sedition, basically. This was introduced, an effort to do this was introduced in 2003, and 500,000 people that back then turned out in the streets, and the administration backed down. Now China wants us again, has stayed away from it since, because it threatens Hong Kong's freedoms, which are really sort of precariously hung on to. They're constantly endangered there. Maybe one of the reasons people understand it so well. China wants to introduce this again. It would shut down free speech, which is one of the few freedoms that people in Hong Kong have been able to exercise. That's already been greatly constrained, attacked, abused in recent times. It would, again, it would make it virtually impossible for them to do a lot of even the peaceful things they've been doing now.
Do you anticipate that this is going to be imposed now?
I think Beijing would like to, and I think it sort of behooves us. Certainly Hong Kong people are protesting these things, this kind of thing already. It would behoove the rest of us to make as big a protest as well about what this means.
Claudia, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your excellent work and your courageous reporting. Come back to us in the new year, if you would.
And
we will be talking with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.